everyone. Welcome into another episode of A Must-Win Game with Maggie Gray. On today's episode, Dani Wechselman will be my guest. She is a host and reporter for the St. Louis Cardinals, and she is a fellow SNY contributor. She is one of the smartest people I know talking about baseball. So we do a little bit of the Cardinals, but a lot about the Dodgers, the Yankees, and a lot more of the contending teams. And although the Cardinals are having a surprising year, we also talk a little bit about being a woman in clubhouses and locker rooms and sort of the best and the worst parts about having that kind of access. So excited for you to hear my interview with Dani. Is an absolute pro and just a fun person with a great perspective on baseball. But let's get a little stock up, stock down. And I got to go stock down here for the Las Vegas Raiders because I can't help but think there's more to the story about this training camp scuffle, fight, whatever you want to call it, between Max Crosby and Kirk Cousins. You could have given me 1,000 guesses of the two least likely guys to get into it in a training camp practice, and I think I would have come back with Max Crosby and Kirk Cousins. Not because Max Crosby doesn't play with an edge. Obviously, he does. But he's not an idiot. He will know and has been in the league long enough to understand you can't touch the quarterback. This is usually something that happens with guys who are either just getting to the league, guys who are worried about making the team. Superstars don't hurt their own quarterback. They don't even get anywhere close. And thankfully, he did not hurt Kirk Cousins. And for Cousins, I mean, probably one of the most peaceful, at least that's his persona, on the outside. I know he's a hell of a competitor, but for the two of them to get into a scuffle and then for both of them to get suspended, first of all, okay, I've seen a little bit about whether this was actually Max Crosby like trying to get traded. I think Joe Johnson, the former NBA star, had that take. I didn't see it that way. I thought this was a big test for Clint Kubiak. And he passed it because he suspended both of those guys for a practice. Like, even if that's a little bit of eyewash, you have to do something. You can't just let this unprecedented, it feels like, thing. Training camp battles like this between a pass rusher and a quarterback, two veterans, I have to imagine that hasn't happened in 2 decades. Clint Kubiak had to do something. But it is further evidence, I think, of just something being so supremely rotten with the Las Vegas franchise. And you could say, Maggie, like, we already knew that. But, you know, think about last year and Pete Carroll, who's known as like one of the great culture setters and tone setters in the NFL. And that thing went off the rails as quickly as humanly possible. You have Tom Brady at the helm, an ultimate winner, someone who is synonymous with football success. And he has, if he is having any influence on the decision-making of this team, it's been all wrong. So now Fernando Mendoza falls into their lap with the number one overall pick, and they just have to not screw this up. And something here is off. And we didn't really get an answer about why these two guys are battling. Now, it's a weird place for Max Crosby to be in. Don't forget, he was a Baltimore Raven for a couple days this offseason, thought he had gotten traded. We know the Dallas Cowboys were trying like mad to get Max Crosby. Then he had some things pop up on his medicals. Baltimore said, no, thank you. The trade gets rescinded. Dallas is now out. But what is it? Like, what could have happened between these two veterans to cause Max Crosby to hit Kirk Cousins on the throwing arm multiple times, both of them, to get suspended for a practice? And the one thing you do not want is Fernando Mendoza walking into just a terrible franchise. And what's funny is that Tom Brady has said if he did not get drafted by the New England Patriots, we'd probably never hear of Tom Brady, implying that if he was in a loser franchise, he would not have been nearly talented enough to overcome the loser franchise, not early on in his career. Is he going to be asking Fernando Mendoza to do something that even he admits he could not do? So, stock down, Raiders. Let's keep going. Stock up, Minnesota Vikings. I like the fact that Kevin O'Connell just made a decision. We all knew that Kyler Murray was going to be the starting quarterback for this team. I said this to McLovin, to Perloff, when he was on the show 2 weeks ago. So this is the easiest quarterback battle Kyler Murray will ever win. J.J. McCarthy is not a starting quarterback in this league, at least not yet. There is no way that you can have a defense that is competent, have a wide receiver in Justin Jefferson, and then roll out a guy who had more interceptions than touchdowns last year, who wasn't particularly smart with the football. And I don't think the team was really gravitating towards him anyway. So it didn't seem like he has actually that intangible, he's going to be our guy. You just have to like give him a little time. He's a little wild now, but he's going to get it under control. This is the franchise telling you, no, we'd rather go with Kyler Murray, but whose career needs to be now resurrected in Minnesota. And he could join another, he could join in a long line of quarterbacks who have had their careers resurrected in Minnesota. I'm looking at the division. It's obviously going to be, I don't say impossible, but it's going to be really hard with the Packers, with the Detroit Lions, and with the Bears. However, if we think the Bears could be a regression team, here's Minnesota with a good defense, with good weapons, with Kyler Murray with something to prove, Kevin O'Connell with something to prove. Don't forget, their general manager was fired this offseason, so now the spotlight is white hot on the coaching staff. Everything could go right here. Now, looked at their strength of schedule. Not an easy schedule, obviously, because they have so many great teams in their division, all of them. But I'm officially putting the Minnesota Vikings as my sleeper team. I don't know how, because the division is so crazy. I am now buying on the Minnesota Vikings. I am buying on Kyler Murray. There is a good quarterback in there. We saw it in 2020. I think with Kevin O'Connell, we can see competent quarterback play. He's got the best wide receiver in the league on his team. Justin Jefferson still is that dude. And the defense has been able to retain Brian Flores, and they are ferocious. They're different every week. Sometimes a little boom or bust. This is a good defense. So count me on buying Minnesota Vikings. They will be a playoff team. Okay, I got to go stock down Nikola Jokic, and this feels like he's catching a stray. He absolutely is. And this is the story. A Greek billionaire who owns the professional team Panathinaikos, very popular in Greece, known worldwide to be a stellar franchise. He says that he made a legitimate offer to Nikola Jokic to leave the NBA and go and play in Greece. And to me, while this is maybe publicity or a stunt, this billionaire would not feel comfortable pulling that with any other superstar in the league. Maybe outside, I guess, Giannis. The fact that he didn't do this for Giannis really shows you that this is a bad look for Jokic. And I'll tell you why. Jokic has not been subtle about the fact that he really doesn't seem to love the NBA. They won the title. He almost, and I don't think this was an act, I don't think he really would have gone to the parade had they not convinced him to go to the championship parade. Like, hey, you got to celebrate with the fans. You can't just run back to the horse farm here. There are certain requirements and responsibilities that come with being a superstar. And the fact of the matter is, somebody in Greece really thinks that Jokic has so little use for the NBA that they could actually poach a two-time MVP who's 1 year away from being eligible for a five-year, $359 million deal, that somehow this person, Jokic, would rather play in Greece. That's bad for Jokic. That's bad for Denver and for Jokic that they have to field calls like that, because Pat Riley's not getting that call. No one's making that overture to LeBron James or Wemby. You don't see some French billionaire saying, Wemby, come and play in this French league. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, they're not saying, like, hey, come play in Greece. They'd be laughed out of the room. And maybe this guy was laughed out of the room, but the fact that he thought anyone would even hear or entertain his pitch for 5 seconds reflects badly on Jokic to me. Maybe I'm being too harsh on him. I think that you are putting out the message and the signal, and it's very obvious that you don't love the NBA. And that's not good. It's not a good look for Jokic. It's the best league in the world. It happens to be the United States. I get that's not your home, but you know what? Not that bad here. Maybe that's too harsh. I didn't like it. Final one. There's a lot of really good things to listen to and things to watch right now as far as like sports content. This season of Quarterback on Netflix has been excellent so far. The combination of Baker Mayfield and Joe Flacco and Cam Ward is not a combo that I really thought that I would get into, but they are all so interesting for their own reasons. Some of the stuff is a little cheesy, I guess, like Baker Mayfield with his family and some of the Hard Knocks-ish types of stuff, but the access is fabulous. The editing is amazing. Like it's got all the things, and it feels a lot fresher to me than Hard Knocks. So I'm really into that. I'm also into, and this is not going to be a shock to people who listen to the Maggie and Perloff show, the 30 for 30 podcast series about Ipe Mizuhara. Ipe Mizuhara was Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, who is currently serving a 5-year sentence in prison for stealing money from Shohei to try to cover gambling debts and also to buy expensive baseball cards. It's riveting, yet there are still questions that do not get answered in this 30 for 30. And I'm not trying to spoil it for you because this is real life. I can't spoil it. You could just look it up. It's not, you know, the ending of, you know, Game of Thrones or something. So there's still a couple questions that are not answered in this 6-part series that, yes, I did enjoy listening to it and going along on the journey. But here are some things I still want to know. Number one, how did Shohei Ohtani not have any clue, any inkling whatsoever that Ipe Mizuhara was ever making bets? I know Ipe could do it on his phone. I understand that he wasn't maybe broadcasting out how much he was betting because he was a compulsive gambler, and also he was losing at an insane clip. But Ipe was making dozens of bets a day. And in Ipe's own statement to the judge, where he's asking before the sentencing for leniency, Ipe lays out just how much time he was spending with Shohei Ohtani. There was no breaks. He was working every single day. And not just that, they're together all day. Ipe says his wife at times made breakfast for Shohei Ohtani, driving him to the ballpark, being with him during the games, being with him after the games, dinners, photo shoots, all promotional shoots, everything that had to do with Shohei's personal and professional life, including, according to Ipe, being at the lawyer's office when Shohei's prenup agreement was being drafted. I mean, Ipe, was there for everything. Not only that, Ipe was also Shohei's employee in the offseason. So he's with him in Japan, not just in LA or in the United States. How did Shohei not know that he was making dozens of bets a day, enough to get himself in debt $16 million. This is dozens of bets a day for months and months and months. Nothing. Shohei, in his own statement when the scandal broke, said he never knew. Second thing, when Ipe first gives an interview to a reporter from ESPN, the story he tells is that he got himself into gambling debt with a bookmaker, and he had to come clean to Shohei Ohtani. And Shohei, while upset about it, said, "I'll help you out this time," and actually did help Ipe make the wire transfers to the bookie to try to pay off the debt. While Ipe was giving that interview to an ESPN reporter, Shohei's own crisis management, crisis PR, was on the line, listening in on the conversation. The reporter knew it, Ipe knew it. It's like there was a third party on the phone who was supposed to be there to represent Shohei's best interest. Not Ipe's. It's not like Ipe's lawyer. This was Shohei's crisis PR. And this guy who's working with CAA, the biggest agency in the world, let Ipe tell this story that they then recanted later that implicates Shohei and didn't say anything about it? I mean, this has to either be the worst crisis PR person ever to go into the industry, or this was the real story. that Shohei was actually trying to help Ipe out and cover for the debt. And either they didn't understand that this was illegal or the ramifications this would have for Shohei to basically be linked to an illegal bookmaker and likely have to get suspended or maybe permanently banned from the sport. How did a crisis PR person working for Shohei Ohtani allow that story to be told? Unfortunately, the podcast never really answers that. We never get circled back, you know, to the crisis PR guy. And then the last point, if Shohei Ohtani did get swindled here and you lay out the evidence, it does look like Ipe was not just a compulsive gambler, a compulsive liar. I mean, he really, it looks like he was just stealing money out of an account he helped set up for Shohei, where all of Shohei's salary from the LA Angels was getting piped directly, routed directly into this bank account. And Shohei didn't touch it. Ipe knew about it. And Ipe told Shohei's financial people, hey, keep this private. Shohei doesn't want anyone touching this account. So Ipe kind of knew he had this piggy bank of Shohei's hard-earned money to bail him out if he needed it. And obviously he started dipping into that. So this whole crisis happens, this scandal. People are questioning whether Shohei Ohtani was actually the one making the bets and Ipe was covering for Shohei, and it's exploding. It's obvious that Shohei's agents really dropped the ball here. If they're supposed to be protecting their client, A, how do you have that dummy crisis PR person on the phone and who allows even more rumors to fly about Shohei's involvement? But you obviously were not protecting his money. You never went to Shohei directly. You had no one else who could speak Japanese, who could talk to Shohei outside of Ipe. Just so many failures by the agency and by the agent, Nesbolelo. Yet Shohei's still with them. That's another thing that never gets answered in this podcast because, well, Shohei doesn't agree to an interview. Why would he stay with these agents when they could have cost him everything? They could have cost him his career, all of his money, his reputation. I mean, they fumbled big time, the agency, and yet Shohei has still been loyal to them. And that's something I don't know, and it never gets answered. So overall, compelling. However, couple questions that never get answered in the podcast. All right. That's going to do it for my little stock up, stock down. Dani Wexelman, she is a host and reporter covering the St. Louis Cardinals. She's also my friend. She's a fellow contributor to SNY. Not a lot of Mets talk, so don't worry about that. Not really much to talk about with the Mets. A little bit with St. Louis, though, and their surprise season. And then we get into the Dodgers. We get into the crazy play between Toronto and Boston and how the umpires royally screwed that up. And so much more.
Yeah, great questions. And I think that everyone is kind of wondering the same thing. And I still stand true to what I said. I do think it's the year before the year, and it's the year of opportunity, the year of learning. They definitely outkicked their coverage, I think, in the first half and got everyone really excited because of the way they were playing. And I think they learned a lot from the end of last year, took it into this year. You've got guys who are playing their natural positions, guys who have more experience. You really can't undervalue reps. Everyone needs more repetitions in life, and that includes big leaguers. A lot of these young guys like Jordan Walker and Nathan Church needed more time to cook. I like to say cook and develop, right? And they got called up. And so then it's on the Cardinals to develop them at the big league level. And so that's part of why and how they've been able to be so good is because they're still learning, but the Cardinals are investing with them at that big league level. So that's number one. Number two, they have more manpower. They have more people. It's not a sexy answer. It's probably not what people are expecting. But when you are an organization that didn't have a person to help you understand data and analytics from new technology, but you have that, it's useless. Now the Cardinals have more people in place with their new technology that they have and some things that I think they're back to where the standards are. The Cardinals used to be the standard. Everyone else caught up. And then the Cardinals became, in my opinion, in my personal opinion, complacent. And because they were winning so much and it was working until it wasn't. So I think like guys who are bought in, a young staff, a young team, and still understanding that you have to learn and develop at the big league level. You're not done. And they have like fully leaned in and bought into that.
That's interesting. You really buy that one season can kind of, bleed over into the next, because obviously I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about the New York Mets because they're in literally last place in the NL East. But I think that's sort of the thought, like, at least get something going this year and perhaps it could carry over into next year. I think people are split. Like, some athletes I hear every season is different. And then sometimes things actually can start growing the season before and then just continue to manifest.
The Mets situation, I feel like, is more of an outlier because they brought in so many new people, and not just new people, but veteran people and players who have been in the league for so long. And some of them, like Bo Bichette, with the same team for so long, it's not the same carryover. It's almost impossible to have that carryover. And I'll give you another example, the Toronto Blue Jays, who have almost the same exact team and there's no carryover, right? It didn't actually work in their favor. But I think because the Cardinals, they trend as the youngest or the second youngest team age-wise all season long. It's young guys who have come up together, key there, right? Draft and develop and pay attention to who you're bringing up. Those things are important. Homegrown players are important. But that's why I think there is carryover, because you have young guys who their first few years or full years, like, don't forget too, a lot of these guys on the Cardinals have not even played a full season of Major League Baseball. That, like, matters more than people realize, more than anyone is going to talk about, because again, it's not sexy to talk about service time or reps or experience, but generally those things are actually like the gateway to success. You could have all the talent in the world. Joe Adell is my favorite example, but you don't have the reps, and then you have the reps and you put it together. So I think the Cardinals have the carryover because of their age and homegrown together. On the Mets side of things, like, and you've been in the weeds more than I have with them this season, but like, personally, I felt like the Marcus Semien trade actually was the derailment of what could have been, because they had so many other guys they could have put at that position. And then pretending or gaslighting fans into thinking Jorge Polanco was going to play first base and play it well, a huge mistake, right? And so those two felt like the demise to me. And so there's no way to carry anything over when you make moves like that.
Yeah, and like, think about those two positions. One was getting Marcus Semien, but you're trading away Brandon Nimmo, who doesn't play second, but was a big factor in the clubhouse and a homegrown Met. And the other was first base with Pete Alonso and trying to, replace Pete Alonso and saying that his defense wasn't good enough when, Jorge Polanco never played the position. But in the weeds is a great way to talk about the Mets this year. It feels like a thick forest that, like, you can't see the end. You mentioned with the Blue Jays, because that is also fascinating about what happened. You know, they seemed like, I know you get to game seven of the World Series, you lose in the way that they lost. Like, yeah, that has to haunt you, no doubt. But they still have all the talent in the world. What do you think has happened?
Yeah. Okay. So, like, you could probably point to a couple of different things. Number one, I think it is impossible to replicate the magic that they had last year, even if Bo Bichette was back. I still think what they did is, it's special because it doesn't happen often. So I didn't assume it was going to happen again. Now you could look at Vlad Guerrero Jr. and you could look at the fact that now, I don't know if we're recording this, he's hit a home run at home, but as of a few days ago, right, the beginning of August, he had not had a home run at home. So if you want to dive into the numbers and what he's got going on, the only thing that really stands out to me is he is swinging outside the zone almost career high. Last year was 21%. I just looked at this. This year it's 31%. So, like, he's lost. And I just saw him. The Cardinals went up to Toronto. I just saw him. And it feels like he's lost. It feels like he's 0-2 out of the box and out of the gate. And he's still hitting the ball, like, ridiculously hard. He's hitting rockets, but they're not falling. He's lost his power. That's a big part of it. When you don't have your slugger, you don't have your guy performing the way that he needs to. They had a lot of injuries early as well. And their starting staff has just been okay. And they're in the AL East. So if they were in another division, they might be hanging around right now. They're only a couple back of the wild card. But I don't know, Maggie. Like, I don't know what you think, but I think what they did last year was irreplaceable this year.
Yeah, it's funny though, like, sometimes I think back to, let's say, the Kansas City Royals from like a decade ago, and they went to the World Series and they lost, and they went back and they won. And obviously that was against who else but the Mets. You know, you've watched the Texas Rangers get back back to back, you know, even though they lost both of those, unfortunately. But you do see teams who are able to get back after these really difficult losses. And it just feels like Toronto's gone the other way. Quick aside, though, and we're recording this on Monday night. The crazy thing that happened in that Blue Jays Red Sox game, talk about a tale of two different teams going different directions. But the fact that there was, you know, basically they lost track of how many outs there were in the inning. The game stops for 16 minutes. They award the run to the Red Sox, but they shouldn't have, or the rule seems so convoluted about a timing rule. If you pass the home plate, and then have the third out at first, even though the guy didn't tag up at third. And this season, I feel like has been more about technology than any other, because the ABS system is in the major league level. And I love the ABS system, but it just feels like, I don't know, are we getting any closer to the truth here? Because yesterday was crazy.
I'm exhausted thinking about the technology that's going on in our game right now. And listen, I like a lot of it, and I'm not get off my lawn ever, but I do think, and just in my conversations with people too in the league, that we've gone past a point. The sport is about the human element. Right. And the human element slowly is being eliminated every year. There's something else that's taken out. The sport, that's the essence of the sport. The essence of ABS should not be that you get or don't get a strike call by 1/10 of a centimeter or a millimeter, right? That's not the rule. That's not the point of the rule. And so I feel like we've taken some steps backwards in that regard. And it makes me sad because the sport is supposed to be show up, watch, see what happens, don't know when it's going to end, right? Crazy things can happen every single night, which still is happening. But I do think that, I think even like analytically and statistically, I think maybe we're like a toe too far right now. And I'm a little concerned if we don't keep ourselves in check in the sport, eventually like it's going to be so robotic, you're taking away the entire point of baseball.
Yeah, I mean, you could have just been talking about society, by the way, like with artificial intelligence. I'm like, we're taking out the human element of everything that we do. From the players that you're talking to, because you're talking with them all the time.
Yeah.
Do they like ABS? You know, I kind of feel like it's showed us who the smart guys are versus who the less smart guys are. Or is it more pressure on them?
No, they like it. They like it a lot. I think that they're learning still what situations work best. The Cardinals have kind of been like, do what you think fits. The trend for them has often been the sixth inning or later. It's very rare to see these guys make any challenges before. That's just the Cardinals. But the guys on this team do like it. And I think behind the plate, like they have an incredible eye. You're primarily seeing with most teams, the catcher, making that call. And it's really fascinating to watch. And then mostly I think for the Cardinals too, like the catchers, like Yvonne Herrera or Pedro Pajes, Jimmy Crooks, if they're hitting, they're also making more challenges, right? Because they know the strike zone so well, and they miss by slim margins, but they're right a lot of the time. Pedro Pajes in particular is one of the best in the league. So these guys like it, and I think for the most part, like they understand when and when not to use it, and it's benefited them pretty well.
Want to ask you just a couple more, and again, thanks for doing this.
Girl.
The Dodgers, not so far removed from a 7-game losing streak. You know, Tarek Skubal had not a great outing, but again, like even the best of the best are going to throw some clunkers now and then. And it was his LA Dodger Stadium debut.
Yeah.
Are the Dodgers a little more vulnerable though, than we're giving them that we're making it out to be? Cause I think after the Skubal trade, it was like, well, slam dunk, the World Series has been won already. Give it to the Dodgers. Do you see it that way?
Oh my gosh. It literally makes me want to throw my microphone at my laptop and throw my laptop in the ocean when I hear that. Cause we've heard that narrative for a few years now. It is a lazy narrative because it's not true. Have they won back to back? Yeah. Could the Jays have won last year? Should they have won last year? Yeah. But Dave Roberts is really smart. Dave Roberts has a powerhouse team. And ultimately, like, they were the smarter team in that scenario. And so, like, I think hearing him say we're a wild card team right now, that tells me that Dave's trying to rev his guys up. Like, I don't think Dave Roberts actually believes that. But I think that he's just trying to give him a little gut check. A gut check is good. Like, am I rooting for dynasties in sports? Not necessarily, but I do think that this team losing is good for them. I think internally, learning how to lose and come back is very important. When you feel like you're coasting and you're like, oh, we're going to get Tyler Glass now back. We're going to get Blake Snell back. We're going to get Will Smith back and we're going to be fine. Like, to me, that doesn't teach you anything. And especially the next generation coming through the Dodgers, right? Think about Andy Páez and like, how do you learn to come back and win? So I like that they lost. I was glad they went on a losing streak. I was glad to see them humanize a little bit. I don't think they're a wild card team. I think that's a tall tale. That's a Paul Bunyan tall tale from Dave Roberts, maybe just to try to get things going. But that's not the truth. I do think they need to play better, and they've got some holes, but not many. And I'm hopeful that we have a really great postseason again. Last year was incredible, but I think the losing streak is good for them. What did you think? What did you think about it?
So I saw the Dave Roberts quote and I was like, all right, seen this before, you know, this is the Nick Saban, this is rat poison, you know, like any, like, you know, yeah. Trying to just motivate his guys, and listen, he knows them better than anybody. So we'll see if it works. What I thought was a little weird was a detail that Brandon Gomes is GM of the Dodgers,
yeah,
technically.
Yeah.
Walking through the clubhouse after Monday's game and telling them, guys, reminding them, we had a worse record last year at this time. See, that to me, I'm like, wait a minute, are guys losing confidence? Because why would you have to remind them, hey, we actually had a worse record this time the last two seasons and look what happened? First of all, I don't love when the general managers walk through the clubhouse after a game anytime ever. Yeah. I think it makes guys tight, even if it's at home. I think it makes guys tight. I think it makes them feel like something's weird. And I don't love that. I kind of like GMs to have a little bit more of a, like, keep their space, like, keep out of the clubhouse unless you're spraying champagne on each other.
It's fair point.
Like, I'm a yeah. little like separate church and state there.
Yeah.
But my ears perked up on that one. I'm like, why does he feel like he has to pump these guys up?
Yeah. Again, I think I just go back to like, they are, that's not a real narrative. Like genuinely, I don't think that it is. I think that is like, when you watch them speak, or you like even watching Mookie Betts podcast, like watching them go back and forth, they have really honest conversations. And listen, I don't know those guys personally, but I never feel like they think they're out of it or they don't think they're going to win another World Series. Do I think that Roki Sasaki is going through mental gymnastics this season and struggling? Yeah, I do. Do I think there's probably a couple other guys like Emmett Sheehan who are having those same issues? Dalton Rushing. Like, I like Dalton Rushing a lot. Saw him in college at Louisville. Like, I think that he has gone through the ringer this year. I think he's probably contributed a little bit to that, but the media has just absolutely zeroed in on him. Like, there are some things going on there, but by no means do I think anyone in that clubhouse thinks that they're not going to win another World Series.
Last one for you is about the Yankees. So this is a team that keeps winning despite the fact that they can't score. It's kind of wild. And yeah. I see that Aaron Boone and others sort of spin it as a positive. Like, hey, these are the type of tight games we're going to be playing in the postseason. This is good tune-up for us. Are you buying yeah. that? Does it seem like BS? Or do the Yankees have a reason to be concerned? I mean, listen, even if Judge and Stanton do come back
yeah.
and they're fully like, they're going to need a little time to work themselves back into game shape. So,
oh, yeah.
And are they both going to DH? Like, that's another question for another day, but like, are you concerned about the Yankees or no?
Well, Aaron Judge will definitely have to go on a rehab assignment. Like, there's no doubt about that. So like, to me, it's like mid September to end of September. If you're looking at the timeline right now, maybe he gets lucky and it's, you know, it's in a couple of weeks, but I would be really surprised if that was the case. Why would you rush him back at this point? If you've been able to hang around holding the second spot in the division, you've got a wild card, right? Like, you could catch the Rays at the end of the season. I could see it coming down. I don't know their head to head off the top of my head, but they could catch them. You never know. I could certainly see that happening. I just saw them, so I got a pretty good taste of what's going on there. Obviously, the pitching is elite. I will say the Cardinals got to Cam Schlittler. They ran him out early. It was the second or third inning. They drove his pitch count up. He didn't have his stuff. Kid's going to be human, right? He's going to have human moments. My biggest concern is the bottom of the order for these guys. I think it was shocking that they didn't get an offensive catcher. And I hear we're not going to get Adley. They're not going to give Adley because he's in the division. Ryan Jeffers from the Twins became unavailable. There were other avenues potentially they could have explored. I know the Marlins ended up trading their catcher. So I was surprised to see them not upgrade at that position. I like Austin Wells defensively very much, and I watched him have better at-bats throughout the Cardinals series. And Ryan McMahon had a couple better at-bats too, but the bottom of that order, man, starting with Jazz, like that is where my heart starts to race a little bit. And I'm concerned about what they'll be able to do in October. Any good postseason team has got to have one or two guys that's locked in. Maybe they will to turn it back to the top. The top four or five are going to do your damage. The Yankees bottom of the lineup is a tough watch right now. And so that's really where I'm mostly concerned about them. But here's the thing is, don't you think, like, I think we've been around long enough to know that they can get it together. There is still time. They're hanging around. They haven't really lost a step, despite the fact that there are deficiencies in different places. They haven't lost one single step. It's not like they're 10 back, right? They're still within reach of the division, which is really the prize for them. They do not want to have to go through the wild card again.
Yeah, to not have any Yankee Stadium home advantage, I think, would be a disservice. But the other part is, I'm also not as concerned about the bullpen as others are. Like, I get it. The pitch counts, or the innings counts rather, are piling up on some of the more high leverage guys. But I think they believe that they're going to be able to seamlessly move guys from the rotation into the bullpen. And we watched the Dodgers, I feel like, do that. And they've done it spectacularly in the postseason. So I think the Yankees probably feel the same way. It was still a little stunning they didn't have a bullpen arm and they traded some away. But that's, to me, not the biggest sky is falling. All right, Danny, last one for you.
Okay.
I don't know about you. I get a lot of questions from fans about what it's actually like to be in clubhouses, to be in locker rooms. Now, sometimes I think they're asking that because, like, maybe they're, I don't know why people ask that, but it's definitely the number one question I get. Give me the best thing and the worst or most awkward thing about being in the clubhouse as much as you are.
Yeah,
and
that's
it's the
a really
one thing
good
that
question.
Athletes always say they miss the most once they retire.
Yeah, I think the best part is there's when you walk in, and depending upon the time and how many people are in there, my favorite part is when I need to go talk to somebody. There's a group of guys, and if you have a good relationship with them, you can walk up and you kind of join their in progress conversation. And you're kind of water cooler, and you're doing that thing, but you're listening, and then you can pick your guy off and go talk. But I like watching them hanging out. Like, I think it's really cool to see them, like, geeking out about something or watching a video or watching. There's games on in the clubhouse. Like, they're watching whatever game is on. Like, they're watching it just like we're watching it, and they're talking about it too. So I love doing that. I think that when it's a relaxed moment, it's early in clubhouse, and maybe it's the second day of a series, so there's a lot less responsibility. Like, those are some of my favorite moments. Or if someone is recalled, someone is has been called up to debut, like, those moments are pretty special in the clubhouse. Like, I like those a lot. And then I think my least favorite is probably your least favorite, is just trying to navigate my eyes and where I should be looking when guys are coming in and out of shower or whatever they're doing for the day, and just trying to make sure that my eyes are where they're supposed to be and not catching a glance of something that I don't want to see and I want nothing to do with. I think that's probably my least favorite, is just walking in and being ambushed by that. But you know, that is what it is. And I think that we've probably learned to navigate it as well as you can, but those are probably my least favorite. Is that your least favorite?
Yes. I've learned eyes up is always the safest. Like, you would think that when I walk into a locker room that it's like the Sistine Chapel. Like, I'm like looking at the ceiling, like Michelangelo painted it. And it's like, I'm seeing frescoes, you know?
That's it.
My favorite part of the clubhouse, I never took any of it because, like, it wasn't my place to take it, but there was always like a wall full of candy.
Oh.
And just like the food, like, was always very fascinating to me about what guys were eating. Cause you think they're like these well-oiled machines, like everything they're putting in their body, like, it's a lot of crap. It's a lot of junk.
So much candy. So much candy. JoJo Romero had a locker dedicated to containers of different kinds of candy. It was Like, I felt like there should have been a Buddha on top and like there was a light coming down. It was like the treasure trove of the clubhouse. He just got traded to Milwaukee, but JoJo had the candy stash for the guys, which is, I loved it. You're totally right. You're totally right.
This is like, this is, it's a lot of high fructose corn syrup happening in these locker rooms.
There's a lot of clubhouses. Red nine. Yeah.
Oh, a lot of red nine. Yeah, it's just, it's, everyone is addicted to sugar if you're a major leaguer.
That's right.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you so much. You're the best for doing this, and just enjoy this last part of the season with this like shocking Cardinals year. Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of A Must-Win Game. If you are watching on YouTube, or if you're not, if you could hit subscribe, that would be so helpful. It's a small thing you can do, helps me out an absolute ton. You can follow me on social media at Maggie Gray on Twitter, at Maggie Talk Sports on Instagram, and at A Must-Win Game on YouTube.